Hey there, I'm Stephen Dubner. This is Freakonomics Radio. Today's episode is slightly, how shall we say this, potty-mouthed. In fact, it's potty-themed. Part one is actually called Take Back the Toilet, and I mean that literally. So if you happen to be eating or cooking or just hoping to not be grossed out for the next hour, well, don't say you weren't warned. So, Levitt, here's a question for you today. Would you agree that you and I are fundamentally pretty different people?
Yes.
Okay, I would too. But of all the ways in which we're different, what would you say is maybe the biggest difference?
Probably that you like people and I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not what I was thinking of.
Okay.
Here's the one I'm thinking. You seem to be almost entirely unaffected by your physical surroundings.
That's true. That's completely true.
Whereas you ridicule me for being too sensitive. Like, if the lights go out or something, you're like, hey, Dubner, just keep working. What's the problem? You know? But like, when you're working or even, you know, filling out your horse bedding stuff, you could be in the desert. You could be in a room with 150 decibels. You're just a machine. It doesn't matter to you. Would you agree that that's a pretty fundamental difference between us?
I think so, yeah. But there's a downside to it, too, which is that when I get dragged to nice places, I never appreciate them.
Maybe so. You make up for it in other ways. But here's a scenario that really bothers me that I want to talk to you about today. But you may be the wrong guy to talk about it, too, because I have a feeling it doesn't bother you at all. So you and I both travel a lot, fly a lot. And here's my thing. In airport restrooms, particularly, but in public restrooms of all types, they are usually totally devoid of any music or other masking sounds. So it's like you walk in and it's like a library, punctuated by the sound of traveling men using toilets. And it drives me batty. Does that bother? Do you even know what I'm talking about?
No, it doesn't upset me the way I'm sure it upsets you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed it? Have you ever noticed, like, let's say, we don't need to get too graphic here. Although with radio, it's probably easier to get graphic. But, you know, you walk into a men's room and there's three zones, right? There's the sink zone, the urinal zone, and the stall zone. And it's the stall zone that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I try to stay away from the stall zone. I'm pretty good at staying away from the stall zone.
Believe me, I do too. I do too. But, you know, audio waves travel into the sink zone and the urinal zone and the in and out zone. And so in that, I feel like when I hear what's going on in that stall zone, I think, how can I invest more heavily in gastroenterology? Because the needs of American men are plainly huge. It just sounds like a MASH unit of people in gastric distress. And I hate it. You've never been bothered by this?
Oh, it's disgusting. But honestly, I really try to avoid restrooms where there are lots of men doing fireworks, you know? Mm-hmm. So maybe we're not so different in that particular regard. It's just that maybe my own abilities to avoid these places are stronger than yours.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Here's what confuses me. Just about every public space you go to these days, you'll hear music being played or some kind of a soundscape. Stores, restaurants, the doctor's office, the gym, the airport, the rental car counter at the airport, the gas pump outside the rental car counter at the airport. So that's a lot of sound to deal with. And the one place you want to hear music, at least the one place I want to hear music, the public restroom. It, for some reason, features only the sounds of nature, which are, to some ears, unsettling. And why is that? And how does all that music in other places affect us? Does it really make us buy more in stores, eat more in restaurants? If you want to know the answer to questions like that, you have to start with Ronald Milliman. He spoke to us from his cabin on Lake Barkley, Kentucky.
I'm actually in the western part of Kentucky.
Milliman is retired. He spends a lot of his time here fishing.
Mostly bluegill and red ear and bass and catfish. I like to fish for it, catch catfish. So pretty much, I just like to fish. So I just like being out on the lake. You go out in the early morning and it's just so quiet and peaceful, and you hear the birds and hear the waves splash against the side of the boat. And it's just really, really nice.
Milliman was a professor of marketing at Western Kentucky University. Before that, when he was getting his PhD in Arizona, he worked at a radio station.
One of the assets that we had at the radio station was a FM subcarrier where we could transmit like background music into stores and doctor and dentist offices and that sort of thing.
This got Milliman to wondering.
I wanted some idea of what kind of music affected, you know, what kind of music to provide, and there wasn't much of any research out there at all on it.
Muzak, the company that got famous for making background music or elevator music, did make some research claims, but Milliman found it completely unscientific. He says they claimed their music did amazing things.
Reducing turnover, increasing productivity, helping in terms of job contentment, a number of things like that. And as I recall, they had some research that showed that it could increase the milk productivity of cows and the egg productivity of chickens, which later when I got into it, it wasn't very scientific. But at any rate, because there was no research particularly done in that area, it's something that I made note of and thought, well, gee, this is something that I could pursue.
Now, there's one more reason why Ronald Milliman might have been a little bit more interested than the average person in measuring the effects of sound.
I had perfect vision until I was 8, and through a very rare illness that I contracted when I was 8, I lost most of my vision. I had partial vision from about 8 to 17. Then I lost my eyesight at 17, the rest of what I had, through a very freak wrestling, actually. I was a varsity wrestler on my high school wrestling team. I was totally blind through undergraduate and graduate school. Then there was a doctor in Houston that felt he could restore my vision.
By now, Milliman was in his first academic job at the University of Texas at Arlington. He went in for surgery.
And sure enough, it did restore my vision. Matter of fact, I had incredible vision. I had like 2015 vision or 2010 vision or something. I mean, it was just 2020 is normal vision, and I had much better than that for a while. But it was a real challenge to keep it because there was lots and lots of complications that I really wasn't hardly prepared for.
With these complications came many more surgeries, more than 50.
I had vision for about 4 years or thereabouts. I was actually driving a car and everything. And then, again, through complications, I lost it all. I lost it totally permanently. So I've actually lost my eyesight twice.
Blind again, he turned back to sound for his research. There was a grocery store in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
It just happened that I knew the manager of the store some.
This manager agreed to let Milliman set up an experiment.
Well, we wanted to know whether the background music affected behavior in any way.
Here's how they set it up. They'd play fast music, slow music, and no music, and see if it changed how people shopped.
So then comes the question, all right, then how do you define slow and how do you define fast?
Milliman and the other researchers played music for a group of people who shopped at the grocery store. They asked them, do you think this is slow music? Is this fast?
So as I recall, the slow music was something like 72 or 74 beats per minute or slower, I think.
So that would be something like this.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
Or this.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling.
And the fast music was something like 94, 96 beats per minute and faster.
Like this.
Let me go on. Like
or this. Now, the actual music they used in the experiment, slow or fast, would have no lyrics.
And then we positioned graduate students that appeared to be like ordinary customers, like they were looking at a can of peas or whatever it might be.
The grad students had stopwatches and notepads. They watched people and timed them as they shopped. One day they'd play fast music, another day slow music, another day no music at all. This went on for roughly 2 months, so they'd have plenty of observations. They also stopped shoppers as they came out of the store and asked them, do you remember if there was music playing in the store when you were shopping? Here's what Milliman wanted to know.
If how fast people traversed the store, if it made any difference, for instance, how much they purchased or whatever, or what they purchased. But the other part of the study was how aware of the music were they when they were in the store. Were they real aware of the music playing, or were they unaware of the music playing, or whatever?
So what'd they learn?
And so what we found is that with the fast music, they did traverse the store more quickly, and it was significantly more quickly.
What do you think happens when people move through a store more quickly? Yep, they don't buy as much stuff. But what happens when you play the slow music?
Yeah, now that's a really interesting one, because sales were significantly greater. And when I say significant, I mean literally in the scientific statistical sense. Significantly greater sales with the slower music playing than with the fast background music playing.
With fast music playing, the Dallas grocery store did about $12,000 in sales each day. With slow music, $16,000. Interestingly, most of the shoppers, when asked upon leaving the store about hearing music, couldn't recall whether or not they heard music. Furthermore, there wasn't a statistically significant difference between no music and slow music, or no music and fast music, but between slow music and fast music, a difference. How did Milliman explain this?
The theory was, and we have reason to believe this is pretty accurate, is that people simply, as you slowed them down, they saw more that they remembered that they needed, or they saw more that they wanted.
For Milliman, the takeaway from this one study was pretty obvious.
Well, it's clear that music does affect people's behavior in a lot of different ways.
This study was one of the first in a field that would come to be known as atmospherics, how sound and smell and other factors influence our behavior. Milliman did a ton of work in this area. One study was similar to the grocery store study, but this time he did it in a restaurant. There, too, he found that slow music makes people linger, which is great news if you're trying to sell more alcohol or maybe dessert. And if you need to turn over tables faster, yep, bring on the fast music. By now, there's been enough research that we know a good bit about how we're affected by different types of music and other sounds. The right music can reduce stress for a patient waiting for surgery, can help a kid do better on math tests. Classical music leads people to buy more wine than top 40 music. But the wrong music or the wrong sounds can be bad for you, too. If you work in an open office, for instance, also known as a cubicle farm, you're more likely to be stressed out, less productive, less satisfied. That's in large part because you are getting a lot of stimuli that you don't ask for, like other people's conversations and phone calls. And you can't simply shut these out, no matter how good you think you are at concentrating. We all have a limited amount of auditory bandwidth. And as the sound expert Julian Treasure likes to say, we don't have any earlids. This becomes more of a problem when you're hearing someone else's noise, someone else's music, everywhere you go. Everywhere except the one place where you want some music, the louder and faster the better, please. The bathroom. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, it's time to take back the toilet.
Anything. Literally anything would be better than nothing.
Used to be an Italian restaurant in California that I would go to, and they piped in Italian lessons. And so while you're in the bathroom, you're hearing, can you tell me where is the train station?
And one more thing, since you don't have any ear lids, maybe you'd like to keep filling your ears up with more Freakonomics Radio. You can find our complete free archive, more than 250 episodes, at Freakonomics.com. You can also listen or subscribe at iTunes or wherever you get your podcast.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So there's a lot of music in public places, in part because researchers have found that music has a strong influence on how people behave in public places. So you can see why they play music in stores and restaurants and airports, even surgical suites. But why don't they play music in public restrooms? That is the question we are asking today. I know it may strike you as juvenile, kind of thing no one in his right mind would ask, but we are not the only people who've ever thought about this.
The toilets in Abu Dhabi are fine. They're good.
That's Harvey Mollich. He is a professor of sociology and metropolitan studies at NYU, recently posted at NYU's Abu Dhabi campus.
The toilet really, in a way, is my landing spot because it's where all of these issues of city and of artifact and design all come together, particularly in the public restroom.
Mollich's broad mandate is urban design, but he is more narrowly a toilet scholar. One of his books is called Toilet: Public Restrooms and the Politics of Sharing.
Our knowledge of the history of public restrooms is very scattered, but one of the things that we do learn is the extraordinary variation there has been in the history of the world. In the Roman Empire, they had quite marvelous plumbing for their time and the aqueducts and so forth. And one of the things they applied that to was public restrooms, the baths. And the baths were, in general, a very social place. People went together, they met up together, and some of the rooms held as many as 60 people.
The setting, Mollich says, was quite beautiful, with mosaics on the floor and the walls.
The toilets are arranged in a sort of semicircle. They're built of stone, a single slab of stone, with a series of holes. And the people are sitting as close together as we sit when we sit on toilets in public restrooms.
So there were no stalls, at least not what we think of as stalls today.
One of the interesting things is that they wore togas. So the toga was their stall. By wearing the toga, you have a way of keeping your private parts private, even as you're sitting on the toilet.
But Mollich agrees that modern public restrooms can be pretty unpleasant, and we shouldn't really expect them to get better anytime soon.
One reason it doesn't change is that toilets in general and public restrooms, there's a taboo around them. And where there's a taboo and you can't speak freely about something, it becomes a place where there's not accountability. So whereas the iPhone, we can question how come it's like this, how come it's like that, wouldn't it be better to this or that or a sofa for the living room, you can't really talk through a toilet.
Now, it's one thing for someone like me, a resident of the richest country in the history of the world, to complain about the setup of public restrooms, but let's be real. The bathroom taboo that Mollich is talking about has much, much, much bigger implications.
So the distribution of toilets of any kind is very skewed. And in some countries, India being a prime example, Pakistan, there is an absence of facilities. And what that means is that people go in the open. They use whatever trench they can find, whatever hole there might be. This is a problem of sanitation, and it means that the mixing of human feces with water supplies happens, and babies die. So children under five, that's the second largest cause of death. Almost 50% of the population of India is defecating under those circumstances. One of the other aspects, it means that women are put at a huge disadvantage and subjected to security worries because they've got to make their way in the night, very often in darkness, to go to the common place where this is done because of other problems, cultural problems, which is that the very idea that women are going to the toilet itself is a kind of taboo and can't be faced front on.
This taboo, Malich argues, extends to high places, very high places. And that's a problem.
Because children under 5 dying unnaturally is due, number one, to malnutrition, but very close to it is being poisoned by human waste because these are unsanitary places. And for the president of the United States to go to bat for public restrooms in, say, India would be humiliation for him. So we've got to get the topic on the agenda locally, nationally, and globally.
There are also practical issues, issues of priority and cost. Harvey Malich has served on many building committees.
Even working with the most prominent architects of the world, never is there discussion about the substance of the toilet stalls. And as a result, you get the lowest person typically on the totem pole of the architectural firm is given that job. And then they sort of call up the mass supplier and they just order the same stuff.
One of the things that is kind of interesting is thinking about public restrooms.
That's Joel Beckerman. He's a composer and sound designer.
Think about all the architects and energy that gets put into designing the physical locations that we go to, whether it's bus stations or restaurants or hotels. The vast majority of these instances, they're not putting nearly the same amount of thought into the sound of those spaces, which includes what materials are being used, because that determines the amount of reverberation of sound.
Beckerman's company, Man-Made Music, creates soundscapes for all kinds of spaces, from small to very large, like the Dallas Cowboys Stadium. He's written a book called Sonic Boom, How Sound Transforms the Way We Think, Feel, and Buy. He has a lot of examples of how sound functions in ways that we might not necessarily think about.
In Moscow, actually, their subway is a circle. It is basically a big loop. And one of the ways they give you information in an instant is that one direction, I'm not sure whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise, all the announcements are made by a male voice. And then in the opposite direction in the loop, it's made by a female voice. So that even if you can't understand exactly what's being said, you know which direction that train is going.
Beckerman agrees with Harvey Malich that the sound of the average American public restroom is suboptimal. Why is that? They point out one obvious problem. The walls of the stalls aren't really walls. They don't go all the way up to the ceiling or all the way down to the floor.
I mean, I lived in Britain, I've lived in Germany. They have walls. Italy has walls. Stall walls, that's, you know, step one. Then if you want to get really groovy like the Japanese.
It may not surprise you to learn that bathroom design in Japan is rather advanced. What you're hearing is called the sound princess. As the story goes, Japanese women were so put off by the silence in public restrooms that they'd flush the toilet over and over again to mask the noise, which worked but also used a lot of water. The solution? A device that mimics the sound of an ever-flushing toilet. The Japanese use sound in all sorts of interesting ways. Many towns have intercoms mounted on public buildings throughout the city. This one plays a daily message around sunset. That's in Matsudo, about an hour outside of Tokyo. The woman's voice is basically telling kids, hey, it's time to go home now. The intercoms are networked around cities. They serve as an emergency broadcast system in case of earthquakes, for instance. Here in the U.S., we too have a history of sound design in public places. Joel Beckerman again.
The story is that elevator music began when elevator manufacturers realized that people were very uncomfortable being in close quarters in a closed room, essentially.
So you have to ask yourself, if we feel the need to mask uncomfortable silence in an elevator, wouldn't you think we'd feel the need to mask uncomfortable noise in a public restroom? We stopped into a ladies' room, well, outside of a ladies' room, to ask people what they'd like to hear inside.
What do you think would be the best kind of music in a bathroom? Like, what would you like to listen to?
Anything. Literally anything would be better than nothing. Maybe classical music.
The Beatles.
Always or different kind?
I know, pretty much early Beatles in the public bathroom, I think, would always be appropriate.
I would probably choose to hear Hall & Oates.
Beyonce, 24/7.
I feel bad relegating them to the bathroom because I love them so much. But I love them so much that I would want to hear them that frequently.
Depends on the type of music, I guess. I mean, like elevator music, everyone complains about that. So I feel like bathroom music would turn into elevator music where everyone's like, hey, this sounds like bathroom music.
The sociologist Harvey Mollich, in his tireless pursuit of toilet improvement, once came across something he loved.
There was used to be an Italian restaurant in California that I would go to, and they piped in Italian lessons. And so while you're in the bathroom, you're hearing, can you tell me where is the train station?
Can you tell me where the train station is?
And then you hear it in Italian.
Mi sa dire dov'è la stazione ferroviaria?
So there are many ways to do it in ways that are amusing, charming, and you can try out, have new groups audition and create new acts.
And Joel Beckerman would like to improve the sonic design of airport restrooms.
In a plane terminal, you'd want to be relaxed a little bit. People generally are a little bit nervous when they go flying. So what could we do in terms of putting quiet ambiences in that would mask out the unwanted sound and actually kind of relax people before they got on a plane?
I went back to Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, to see where he landed on this. Okay, so here's the paradox to me. Even you agree that it's not a great thing to listen to, especially if you're an innocent bystander. And here's the paradox. It's not great to listen to, and yet there's very rarely music or other masking noise in public restrooms, whereas in other public areas, like every other public area, hotel lobbies, airports, stores, restaurants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there's a lot of music in public these days, which can be, you know, great or horrible, depending on your preference. Don't you think it's a little bit strange that the one place that I, at least, want a lot of music doesn't exist, and all the other places where we might not want it, it does?
Given your description, how loud would the music have to be to actually protect you from the sounds you're afraid of? Pretty loud, right?
I'm thinking it would sound like the loudest rave you've ever been to, yeah.
I think that's part of the problem, is that I think if there was subtle music, which was then interfered with by these sounds that distribute so much, I think it would only enhance your rage, wouldn't it?
If it were subtle music, you're saying it would somehow highlight or punctuate the bad sounds?
Yeah, exactly, that you'd be listening
really?
To this. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it would be hard. I think from what you're describing, I think that the sounds are so loud that, I mean, they're louder than conversation, right?
Yeah, but there's something about them as pieces of punctuation in the midst of a vast silence, of this pronounced silence that, to me, draws that much more attention to them. I'll tell you, the restroom at WNYC, the radio station in New York where I do this show, you walk in there and it really is like a funeral home. And there you just hear little bitter patter. And then there's a couple stalls back there. And even if you're just standing washing your hands, even if you just go in to wash your hands, you get hit with blam, blam. And then the sounds of human distress. And I'm thinking, this doesn't need to happen. This could be taken care of. We've put men on the moon. We've done a lot of amazing things. And so maybe this is a problem that no one cares about but me, and it's not worth thinking about. But if we were to put your brain on it, any thoughts? Do you think it's worth thinking about? Do you think the public restroom is a place that deserves a little bit of our curatorial attention?
No, I think this is like the penny. It's something only you care about, and no one else cares about it, getting rid of the penny. But I don't know. No, I don't lose any sleep over it. Now, maybe I will now. Maybe now every time I go in a bathroom, I'll be primed to be upset by it. But hey, I just thought the answer.
Tell me.
Well, do you own a set of headphones?
Yeah, no, I believe
me.
Why don't
you just wear your headphones into the bathroom and just turn up your music really loud? It'll be done.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't mind the smell, though?
I don't want to even get into the smell.
See, because for me, the smell would be at the top of the list and the sound would be quite secondary. I would trade smell or sight for sound myself.
Sight? Who's bringing in sight? Now you're taking this already bad idea to a much darker place. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we examine another everyday activity that might be ready for a remake, the wearing of belts. Hey, don't laugh it off. There are health implications.
Around the pelvis, there's a nerve that lives there called the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve.
There are economic implications.
So we believed that this was a sleeping giant for market.
There are, of course, aesthetic implications.
You look ridiculous if you wear a tucked-in shirt without a belt.
That's coming up after the break. And do us a favor, would you? If you don't already subscribe to Freakonomics Radio, go do it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you already do subscribe, why don't you go tell about 500 of your closest friends that they, too, should subscribe.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
You ever notice something that is so commonly used that it's practically ubiquitous, even though it doesn't work all that well? We get used to things, but does that mean they really make sense? I'm sure some examples come to your mind, maybe some medical practice, maybe a political practice, maybe even something where the stakes are really high, like belts. So Levitt, list for me, if you would, all the accessories and items of, let's say, jewelry that you wear in a given day.
You include a belt?
Sure, let's include a belt.
Okay, a belt. Yeah, I've never worn a watch. I've never worn jewelry. I don't...
No cravat?
No.
Mm-hmm. And so for someone who wears no sartorial accessories, why the belt?
Boy, you've left me speechless. I don't know why I wear a belt.
That's Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author. Now, you'd think when I asked Levitt why he wears a belt, he'd give the obvious answer. To hold up his pants. That's what a belt's for, isn't it? Or is it? The late comedian Mitch Hedberg once wrestled with this question.
I got a belt on that's holding up my pants, and my pants have belt loops that hold up my belt. I don't know what's really happening down there. Who is the real hero?
The conventional wisdom seems to hold that wearing a belt is the right thing to do for at least two obvious reasons. Number one, utility.
I mean, well, I am a belt person because it does help. You know, keep up the trousers, you know.
They're needed if you can't keep your pants up.
I always wear trousers that are a bit too big, so if I don't wear a belt, I'm in trouble.
And reason number two, style.
I love belts. I wear belts all the time. I think they complete an outfit.
Yes, I always wear belts. They look good.
I got a belt on right now. I wear belts like pretty much every day. I'd feel like naked if I wasn't wearing it.
So there's a lot of pro-belt sentiment out there. A lot of belt wearers, a lot of belt lovers. Let me get this right out in the open. I am not among them. I don't like belts very much. I don't think they work very well. I find them uncomfortable. I'm always reminded of this on the rare occasions that I do wear a belt when I take it off at the end of the day and instantly feel much better. So I was happy to have a conversation with someone who feels the same way.
For me, it really started back in about 2010 when I was teaching physics in high school.
That's Daniel Sefcik.
I am a data admin for Newbold Advisors, as well as a instructor for Lone Star Community College.
Gotcha. And you live where, Daniel?
Spring, Texas, basically North Houston.
Okay. Let's get back to when he was teaching high school.
And at the time, I had a belt that wore out, you know, had had it for several years. And I thought of a second while I was looking for a new belt about the physics of what I was getting. And I was like, well, wait a minute. This basically works the same as a tourniquet. You know, you strap it on, pull it tight, and hope your pants don't fall down. But the physics of a belt, it pushes in and hopes that it creates enough friction to have your pants not fall down. Well, that didn't make sense. I mean, I was talking to my students about how physics and what direction gravity was pulling and moving things, and here I was wearing a belt. And I thought about it a little bit, and I was like, well, wait a minute. I need something to pull up if gravity is pulling down.
So if you're looking for something to pull pants north while gravity is pulling them south.
Well, that's suspenders. And so I took a look around, started wearing them, and they were exceedingly comfortable. And so from there on out, I was like, well, I'm not going to get any more belts.
No offense to you at all, but why does it take a high school physics teacher near Houston, Texas, to ask this question that surely millions, if not billions, of people have had opportunity to ask before, which is, why are we wearing these suboptimal things when there's something not only that doesn't have to be invented, but already exists that does the job better? Why were you the guy?
I would not subscribe something quite so grand to myself, but as far as why belts rule the apparel choice and the choice of holding up your pants, I'd honestly say that it's mostly social momentum.
Ah, social momentum. Is it true that the belt is superior to the suspender in the eyes of the people who create social momentum?
I mean, suspenders have an image problem.
Valerie Steele is director and chief curator of the museum at FIT, the Fashion Institute of Technology, in New York.
You think of them as being worn by people who are maybe too fat to be comfortable wearing a belt. So you have that image. You have some cool images like punks wear suspenders, but even that is a very kind of aggressive kind of look. So belts, on the other hand, seem much more normative.
But how did belts become normative? Obviously, we need to take a step back.
My name's Chloe Chapin, and I'm a fashion historian, and I teach theater design at Reed College.
So, Chloe, not to be too forward, but what are you wearing right now?
That's a great question. I'm wearing jeans, a V-neck t-shirt, and a sweater, and suede shoes that have purple soles.
Okay, so let's talk briefly about the history of pants, please.
Pants were theoretically invented by the Eurasian horse riders of the Eurasian steppes in the Bronze Age. So like maybe 3000 BC.
And they were wearing what before pants?
Like a tunic or a wrap, you know, sort of like a, you could think of a kilt or a sari or a sarong, any just big kind of cloth that you would wrap around the body that would need to be held up. So belts existed before pants did.
I see. And belts were worn where then? Were they worn kind of more midriff?
Yeah. I think you could think like Braveheart or one of those kind of things where you would use it just to kind of cinch the clothing around you and also as a way to hold up your sword belt.
Ah, okay. So they were functional in at least two or more ways at once.
Exactly. They would hold your clothes onto you and also hold accessories onto you as well.
But then if you want to ride a horse all day, pants are helpful.
Right. It just helps with the chafing.
Oh, with the chafing. Mm-hmm. Right.
But they were not considered fashionable with like the you know, fashionable societies like the classical world, the Greeks and Romans. They never wore pants. They were considered barbaric. You could say that pants really entered into the fashion lexicon based on a Western European system in the early 1800s, like 1820s was when trousers first started to be worn. They had been wearing breeches, which were slightly different, and they only fell to the knee. So these new trousers were cut very high waisted, like above your belly button. And so you had to have suspenders to wear them because a belt wouldn't be functional.
So the belt came along well before the suspender, but there was a time when suspenders took the lead in the role of holding up pants. How then did the belt win? Well, pants themselves became more widespread, worn in more circumstances by coal miners, for instance, who carried heavy stuff in their pockets and needed those pants held up. Recreational sports were becoming more common.
The problem with suspenders is that they're attached to your shoulders. So if you're doing any movements that where your hips and your shoulders are twisting or moving kind of at different paces, like fighting or sports, a belt might be more practical for you. Because, you know, when you if you can just imagine, like, you lift your shoulders up, you can think that if you had on trousers, it might give you a little bit of a wedgie.
Okay. So the belt was...
Whereas a belt wouldn't do that.
A wedgie preventer, right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
The fashion curve was also changing then, as always. Chapin points to the early 1920s when pant waists were lowered. The end of World War I brought a burst of military-inspired fashion, including belts. Cowboys switched from suspenders to belts, in part because a belt could show off a buckle, which might signify a rodeo victory. Other victory belts would come along for wrestling, for boxing, and achievement belts in karate, for instance. The belt became a symbol of strength, of accomplishment. The suspender, meanwhile, would go on to become the symbol of what? Urkel?
As good as I look now, see how studlier I become.
The cater waiter? But if there's one person you're looking to blame for taking the belt mainstream, it would probably be...
The Duke of Windsor. He was a very small man, so it's possible that some of the things that he helped to popularize were just things that looked good on him. If he was a very rotund gentleman, he might have made suspenders popular instead of belts.
The Duke of Windsor, known before his abdication in 1936 as King Edward VIII of the United Kingdom, embraced the belt. At the time, Chloe Chapin says, the belt was seen as a casual and very American thing.
And so oftentimes what these princes were known for was for wearing and making popular a fashion that an older generation would consider to be much too casual. Whether that was, you know, morning coats or belts, they were often sort of trendsetters. His friends that were sitting next to him, and then, you know, those people would have dinner with someone else, and they would be like, oh, after dinner, I'm unbuttoning my jacket, just like the prince does. You know how I hang out with the prince all the time because I'm so important? You know, and then one thing passes on to the next. It's like a celebrity haircut today. You want to associate with someone that you admire or look up to or think is fancy or important, and so you mimic their style.
And this is where we must acknowledge that if you are the kind of person who thinks about clothing as primarily practical, as our listener Daniel Sefcik thinks about the belt and suspenders, well, maybe you aren't thinking about it right.
Fashion is and always has been about much more than function.
Valerie Steele again from FIT.
Back in the 19th century, scholars used to think that fashion developed out of functional needs. But in fact, all the research has shown that throughout world history, people have used clothing and adornment to signal messages to other people. So whether or not suspenders are more functional, quote unquote, than belts is kind of beside the point.
As Steele points out, this notion goes well beyond the belt.
When you can choose clothes that you think are more functional, you could choose to wear sneakers rather than leather shoes or rather than high heels. But it's all going to be relative in what you tell yourself is functional for you. It's like people used to think pants were more functional than dresses. But really, it's all in your head what's going to be important to you. I remember living in Indonesia, and a very famous old artist was invited to come to England, and he refused to come because he said to me with horror, they're going to make me wear trousers and shoes. And this is so uncomfortable and horrible, instead of wearing a sarong and flip-flops or bare feet. So the idea that clothes are primarily functional, it's primarily about what makes you feel comfortable and confident.
You'll have to admit, she makes a good point. The belt is a fairly ubiquitous item, at least for those of us who wear pants. Men are more likely to wear belts than women, in part because men are more likely to wear pants, but also because the male body is shaped more like a tube without the nice rounded hip that prevents pants from slipping down. That's unless you're wearing very tight pants or perhaps pants with a drawstring or an elastic waistband or pants that have been tailored to snugly fit your very own tubular male form. In all these cases, a belt isn't necessary, at least not as a functional item. The fashionability of the belt is, as we've established, a separate and perhaps more salient issue. In any case, there are among us some men who are dissatisfied with the belt, who see it as a poor substitute for, say, the suspenders. Men like Daniel Sefcik of Spring, Texas. So Daniel, let's make you king for a day. Would you take action against the belt or in favor of the suspender?
In the king for a day scenario, I would definitely, if I could, issue everyone a pair of suspenders, probably either black or navy, because that should fit most outfits, and say, okay, for 1 week, I want you to try it.
Valerie Steele of the Fashion Institute of Technology thinks that Sefcik is, how shall we say this, delusional.
The thrift stores would be full of discarded pairs of suspenders. I mean, I think that you would find essentially no women wearing suspenders, except for a handful who wanted to get that kind of, you know, Berlin in the 1920s cross-dressing look. And you get a few fat guys and you get a few punky guys who would like suspenders, maybe a few hapless guys who thought that the Wall Street look circa 1985 was still stylish, who would wear suspenders. But most people would keep on wearing whatever they were wearing before, belts or no belts.
Ouch. Maybe Valerie Steele is right. Maybe the belt is too firmly established as the winner of the holding up our pants contest, and the suspender is irretrievably unfashionable. But before we just accept that and move on, let's at least look at a few empirical differences between the two. Belts, by squeezing inward rather than tugging upward, can be uncomfortable and, if worn too tight, potentially harmful.
Around the pelvis, there's a nerve that lives there called the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve.
That's Ken Hansraj, a spinal and orthopedic surgeon in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Belts can compress it and cause thigh pain, and that's called myralgia paresthetica. So if your belt is too tight and you do not have an adequate amount of girth or fat to protect you, then the belt will be on the nerve, irritating the nerve, causing thigh numbness and sometimes pain.
Hansraj's most recent book is called Keys to an Amazing Life, Secrets of the Cervical Spine. A lot of patients who come to him with pain in their backs or necks have something in common. They wear a belt and use it for something beyond holding up their pants.
When you have, take for example, firemen or medical doctors or plumbers, people that carry a lot of weight around their waist, they're not aware of the consequence of the weight. It's not just the weight. There is a force times distance. And I can tell you from doing other studies that the weight you're carrying around your waist probably weighs 7 to 9 times more to your spine because of the consequence of force times distance.
Suspenders, he says, can offer a lot more support for carrying that weight. That's why you often see loggers and construction workers wearing them. And a couple of police studies found that wearing suspenders along with a duty belt increased comfort and performance. All that said, I get it. I get that suspenders just are not a social norm, not yet at least, and that the belt, for now, reigns supreme. But I can't help thinking that the belt, for all its mainstream acceptance, for all its style potential, for whatever functionality it has, is still a pretty suboptimal solution to the primary problem it's trying to solve, which is holding up pants. And it reminds me, therefore, of another suboptimal solution to a problem that's a lot more important than pants.
I started thinking about car seats when I was doing other research on auto fatalities related to drunk driving.
That, again, is Steve Levitt.
And at the same time, was taking my kids in and out of car seats every day. And I always had the feeling that they flopped around a lot. And among other things, what car seats do is they prop you up really high in the air. And as I was looking at data on car crashes, I came to understand that there were really only two ways you could die in a car crash. One was that you were projected because you weren't restrained at all and you slammed into the glass or were thrown out of the car. And the other was if the space you were in collapsed around you and crushed you. And so in that principle, it seems like the lower the better when you're in a car. And so that was my intuition about car seats, is that they were floppy and they got you up in the air and that might put you at risk. So then we looked at the data.
The data were from the U.S. government, which does a pretty good job collecting information on just about every traffic accident in the country, including the causes, the occupants of the vehicles, whether anyone's been drinking, and whether the passengers were restrained by seatbelts or, in the case of children, car seats.
And what we found in the data was really remarkable. It seemed like the benefit of a car seat, a children's car seat, relative to a child wearing an adult seatbelt was minimal, almost zero. So in our research, in terms of fatalities, car seats didn't help at all. In terms of injuries, mostly relatively minor injuries, it seemed like car seats had a small advantage relative to adult seatbelts. But compared to the mythology that has arisen around car seats, in which people seem to think, wow, these are the greatest invention ever, the facts and the mythology just didn't seem to line up very well at all.
So if you're really concerned about protecting kids in cars, the vast majority of whom ride in the back seat, what would be a better way to rig a car rather than add on car seats?
So I don't even know the answer to that because there's been so little thought and research put into it because the car seat has been king.
Kind of like the belt has been king. To test out the car seat theory, Levitt and I contacted an independent lab that conducts crash tests. We commissioned two tests, a three-year-old size dummy in a car seat versus a three-year-old dummy in a lap and shoulder belt, and a six-year-old dummy in a booster seat versus a six-year-old dummy in lap and shoulder belt. Within minutes, we had some data.
And the adult seatbelt did great. It would have passed all of the federal requirements that they have for car seats. But I think you and I both came to believe that that ironically, the people in this industry really weren't that interested in saving kids' lives. It seemed like they were more interested in selling products and avoiding lawsuits than actually reducing fatalities.
So you just answered my next question, which is why, if car seats aren't really that good at doing the one thing they're supposed to do, are they so omnipresent? I mean, really omnipresent because they're regulated. And I guess the answer is, I mean, how do you describe this kind of weird scenario? You've got automakers who aren't responsible, right, for protecting kids in backseats, really. You've got child car seat manufacturers who are responsible even if their stuff doesn't work that well and they profit from them. And then there's a government who demands it. Is that weird triangulation the reason why we've got this suboptimal solution?
Yeah, I think it's a perfect storm of incentives leading to bad outcomes. So the only people fighting car seats in this entire country, Dubner, are you and me.
Our research on car seats has been controversial. Not everyone agrees that car seats underperform. But the underlying point is a broader one. For car seats and belts and probably a million other things we use every day without thinking about too much, we form habits. We accept conventional wisdoms that may not be very wise. We think that once someone has come up with some kind of solution, there's no reason to rethink it. Well, I think we should all do a little bit less of that. Our working headline for this episode was "Belts are stupid." Out of respect for belt lovers, we ended up toning it down, but I'm not willing to let go of the sentiment. And I'm curious to know what else you think is on some level stupid. What's something you encounter or use or think about all the time that could really use a makeover? Send us your ideas in an email at radio@freakonomics.com. or give us a shout on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, where you can also download the weekly Freakonomics Radio podcast for free.